You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, October 7th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Uber Blocker Digby from the blog Hullabaloo will be here to talk of the massive sedition, is that the word I'm looking for, that we're seeing in the context of our government now. Also, Antonin Scalia, the devil is real. Also, he has great suspicions that he may know a gay person. A couple, maybe even. Big immigration protests around the country this weekend. And as we speak, protests in Boston against Keystone XL pipeline. NSA chief concedes that, well, the things that we stopped weren't all plots and we didn't really stop them. Let's not get into specifics. Also on the program today, well, we hear a bunch of Republicans whining about how mean the other Republicans have been to them. All that and more. Let's do this Fox News story right up front, shall we? This is just too precious. Over the weekend, Fox and Friends Saturday, that is the Siberia that Tucker Carlson has been sent to. We're going over the unbelievable, the fact that President Obama is sitting in office and pulling all the levers to make the shutdown as painful as possible. Of course, focusing in, knowing the president, of course, gets the updates on all the bus tours that are taking place in D.C. as part of his job.
Shut
it down. He sees that, of course, there's a busload of vets going to the World War II memorial, and he immediately has his cabinet form, and they send out word to the federal park rangers. To shut it down before they get there. That's the way our government works, incidentally, for those of you who are three. And Fox and Friends Saturday are opining on this. And wait till you hear at the end. This is an amazing scoop that they have at the end of this report. We'll just come in after they've done all the hard work on finding those vets who have been much maligned, of course, by the president. And then we hear this.
We saw what happened with the World War II memorial this week. You remember when a couple members of Congress came down there with some of the members of the Greatest Generation to try to go to this open-air memorial, this World War II memorial, and some park rangers were saying, you can't come in here. I'm sorry, you can't come in here. Well, this now, they're adding a wire around the outside of this thing to make sure that people don't try to break through. This happened last night on Greta. Take a listen.
Oh, well, we're going to break that down.
They're not going to stop you.
No way. Nothing else did.
What do you make of this fence around the World War II memorial with a sign that says closed?
What a bunch of stuff. You don't want me to say what I really think.
go ahead. This is cable.
This is unconscionable. Unbelievable that they would pull this kind of crap on people like us.
Now, bear in mind, folks, because this is infuriating. Think about these brave men who stormed the beaches of Normandy, right, on D-Day, to try to get into France and stop the horrible atrocities that were unfolding in Europe.
Just to be clear, I think what we were doing on D-Day was we were trying to fight the Germans. He seemed to be struggling to find that. Go ahead.
You can't even go to the cemeteries that are now in Normandy in France because those cemeteries, the United States cemeteries in France, are also shut down. Our government shutdown has also, if they wanted to fly here to Normandy to see where their fellow comrades had died on the beaches of Normandy, those are shut down.
How can you shut down a cemetery or a park? It costs nothing to keep a piece of open land open. It costs nothing to keep the World War II Veterans Memorial open.
Actually, no, you need to have park rangers there so people don't deface it. These are administered, but that's okay. That's just a fact. Go ahead.
The only reason they're doing this is to make people suffer. It's appalling. The government is acting as your enemy. Has this ever happened before? I've never seen anything like this.
Well, and the Republican National Committee is offering to pay for it, to keep it open, so that the veterans, from Honor Flight are going to be able to go and see this, because who did it honor? It honored them. It really doesn't seem fair, especially we're going to talk a little bit later in the show, too, about, some things that are continuing to be funded. And President Obama has offered to pay out of his own pocket for the Museum of Muslim Culture, out of his own pocket. Yet it's the Republican National Committee who's paying for this. And we're going to be talking to Reince Priebus coming up in the show.
What? The president is paying out of his own pocket to fund the Muslim Museum of Culture? That must have come from the National Report, a satire site. And in fact, on October 6th, yesterday, Kumwine, or whatever her name is, who made that statement, tweeted out a correction on Twitter. Just met with producers. I made a mistake, I think that means yesterday, after receiving flawed research about a museum possibly closing. My apologies, won't happen again. What an amazing correction that is. Unbelievable. When are we going to get the correction for the entire program? What we were doing, folks, was also satire. We should have just told you that. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the proprietor of Hullabaloo, of course, Digby. Welcome, Digby. Digby?
Good morning, Sam. Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. Sorry, hold on for 1 second. There we go. Digby. I've just been on an emotional roller coaster with the president funding all these Muslim museums around the country, and then to find out that was just a piece of satire from a satire site. I don't know what to make of it.
I don't either, because it was so believable. That's one of the, you have to forgive the poor girl, because how could she know? I mean, it was just so obviously could be true.
Of course.
Because that's just the kind of thing that he does. You can't really blame her. I mean, the satire is dead in this country because, the president is commonly funding various Muslim, institutions around the country out of his own pocket. So
yes,
why wouldn't they?
And announcing it, of course.
Of course. Well, he needs to signal it to his Muslim allies, you know, around the world, and the terrorists, of course.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, who wouldn't believe that? And obviously, she's a very bright girl, and, you know, a welcome addition to the Fox News family, no doubt about it. I love the fact that Tucker Carlson is now on Saturday Fox and Friends. He's actually sunk lower than Dancing with the Stars, which I wouldn't have thought was possible, but it's actually happened.
Wait till they have Dancing Fox and Friends on Saturday. That's going to be the lowest ebb.
Well, now that I might watch. Yeah, that I could actually watch.
Now, let's talk about, I mean, I want to get to, there's this really fascinating Democracy Corps research document that's floating around that sort of tells us maybe not anything terribly new about the Republicans, but it certainly sort of makes us understand what is happening out there. But before we get there, let's talk a little bit about this New York Times piece that came out. I guess it was on Saturday. And it really just sort of outlines how this has been an ongoing project. This shutdown has been literally been planned since, I mean, for months, if not for years at this point. And in many respects, we're seeing a civil war play out in the Republican Party, but the rest of us are sort of the casualties.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually, isn't it? Although I'm really questioning after reading that, and that's following on, you know, an earlier revelation about this, you know, it was called the Williamsburg Accord, which came out of the Republican retreat that happened in January, in which they sort of strategized their approach to trying to get the sequestration numbers set in stone, and that actually worked. They agreed to a short-term continuation of the debt limit in order to get sequestration actual budget numbers hardened. And then this thing in the New York Times indicates that, I mean, this has been every one of these Republican institutions or conservative institutions working together over the course of many, many months to get this, create these sort of crisis moments where they can basically enact their agenda, primarily, in this case, the defunding of Obamacare. It's very interesting to me because this has been happening in plain sight. I mean, were the Republicans unaware of this? I mean, is that really... I mean, the Democrats, were they unaware of this? I don't know. I mean, was the press unaware of this? Because it seems to me like what we're seeing now is a very, very well laid out strategy. And it's, suddenly we're here and everybody's going, oh my God, these people have gone crazy. They're like children. They're having a tantrum. They refuse to accept what, the reality of, whatever their reality is. And all last year, all we heard was how the Republicans were dying. They, the demographics were against them. They would never win again. They were, and all that may be true. But in the meantime, there was this short-term strategy going on to, bring us to these crisis points that nobody knew about. And it's fascinating. By the way, important to note that it's very heavily financed by their big money boys, particularly the Koch brothers, who I wish $200 million they've put into this.
They have a group called the Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce. I mean, one of the most bizarre things about this New York Times piece is just the amount of times the words freedom the liberty for Americans, for freedom, freedom, liberty, Americans, freedom, loving Americans, and $200 million to nonprofits that were specifically set up to essentially wage this battle against Obamacare. And what's also fascinating to me, and we have a clip of Mike Lee, who is on the Hugh Hewitt show, whining to Hugh Hewitt. We'll play it later in the program, but whining about how his fellow senators were really mean to him and to and the Republican senators. And as far as I can tell, I mean, what's fascinating here is that there's just a series of delusions that have taken place, arguably on part of the Obama administration. I say that arguably only to the extent that starting with the sequester, which was the Obama administration's plan to get everybody to the table for a grand bargain. Then with the sort of the establishment media, which assumes like, oh, you know, cooler heads will prevail. And the Republicans and the Democrats who ignored what was really going on in the Republican Party, so much so that we're brought here and you have these Republican senators saying, you know, we had the plan. The plan was to pretend that we were going to defund Obamacare, not to pretend that we were really going to do it. And like, you know, it's all just sort of set up on this notion that everything's going to take care of itself. And it's this sort of delusion as to who the Republican Party really is.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, it. Yes, they really believe this stuff. This is not, you know, this is no drill here. I mean, this is for real. And, you know, I mean, I don't know about guys like Ted Cruz. I don't know what he believes. I think he's a true believer because he, you know, his history is very interesting. I mean, he came up in a family of right-wingers and has been sort of indoctrinated since he was a little kid. He's been going to, like, John Birch Society meetings and stuff like that. So I don't think he's purely an opportunist. I think it may be that he's, you know, he's both an opportunist and a true believer, if that makes sense.
Oh, yes. I don't think he thinks that there was a real way to defund Obamacare, but I think he's willing to say, like, I'm going to burn down, you know, sort of the vestiges of the Republican establishment because I am the one true leader. And
right.
I think
when I prevail, I will destroy Obamacare. You know, don't worry. I will take care of that. I mean, I think the goals are real.
Yep.
I mean, I think he actually believes in those goals, but I just don't, you know, I don't think he's a cynic, I guess I should say. He's just an opportunist and a true believer. But, you know, these guys, the Democracy Corps memo, which you brought up earlier, is very revealing about this, about how they see this. This is, and it's not like it's anything really new, as you point out. This is something that those of us who've been observing the right for a long time know. I mean, it's just obvious. But it's interesting seeing how they framed it in this memo, because I think it may actually be revealing to people who don't follow it as closely. Because what it reveals is that this is really driven by fear, and it is, you know, pervasive. These people are frightened to death. I mean, this is not just some sort of vague sense of unease. I mean, they honestly believe that this culture is under siege by people who do not share their values, and that they have got to fight back. They have to fight back. And they sort of drew out the various strands of the right, by defining it as evangelicals and the Tea Party being the two conservative, you know, the biggest conservative blocks, and they overlap in certain ways. I mean, I've always felt like they're basically the same,
yeah,
the same group, and there have been previous studies which sort of indicated that. In this, they separate them out, but where they really converge is on the idea that they want people who will fight back, and not just fight back the Democrats. That goes without saying. They want them to fight back the Republican establishment. And that's the biggest part of the Republican Party, the so-called moderates, which I used to just call conservatives, you know, before
right.
they, you know, the Republicans went insane. They're just like conservative. They are about a quarter of the Republican Party, and they are, you know, and a lot of them are evidently women, which makes sense because they're, you know, a lot of the women may be more socially liberal than some of the men. And, you know, they are really marginalized. It's a very, very, you know, I mean, it's getting to be a very narrow group. But these people are motivated almost entirely by fear and paranoia. And, you know, yes, there are things in our culture that you can see why these people, you know, the loss of white supremacy, for one thing, that's
right.
kind of a problem for them. But really and truly, I have to blame, you know, the Republicans created this monster. I mean, this is the conservative movement. Has, you know, they've had a 30-year propaganda campaign that they has been, you know, well-financed, well-oiled machine. Many people are making a very tidy profit at selling this fear and paranoia. And, you know, at some point or another, it was going to end up where we are now with people really believing this stuff. And, you know, I mean, we haven't come to violence yet. I mean, I'm not predicting that we will, but certainly, you know, the way that they talk about what's happening, the way they feel about what's happening in this country is, you know, I mean, it's their fear frightens me because it's so completely at odds with any sense of reality that it's scary that these people are, you know, this paranoid.
On the on the front page of the report, there's a word cloud, which is, you know, for people who are unfamiliar, this is essentially where they create a visualization of the words that are most prominent when referring to their state of mind. And the biggest words are worried, concerned, scared, discouraged about the direction of the country. And what's fascinating to me about this document, and again, we're talking evangelical make up 50% of the Republican base. The Tea Party as a distinct group, and there's obviously some crossovers, another 25%, and then 25% are the moderates. What is fascinating to me is that, and you and I have talked many times about this over the years. I mean, and I think it's because you know, we spend more time actually. There's sort of we hear the term epistemological closure. I may be mispronouncing that. When we hear, like, you know, talk of people are talking about it with Scalia right now because of an interview that he had, and it's quite clear he doesn't look at any news outside of literally, like, you know, red state emails and listening to talk radio. But I think the establishment in this country, whether they are, you know, center left or center right, have a similar closure. They don't understand what's been going on the right. They have no idea. They poo-poo the idea of, like, oh, Rush Limbaugh. There is nothing in this Democracy Corps report. There is nothing in the words of Antonin Scalia that have not been said over and over again by Rush Limbaugh. And they don't understand that basically the base of the Republican Party, the vast majority of the Republican Party, is essentially are like they think they're in Masada. They think that the gays are coming for them, and so much of it is about the gay right now, and then the communists, I guess, the socialist communist gays. And they're coming for them.
Coming to get their guns.
And they have this notion of, you know, we are under siege. And so the idea that they have been fed this sort of one true path, you know, because I'm getting these red state emails, and these emails are telling these people, we're winning. We're about to defund Obamacare. Meanwhile, The Republican Party, the establishment, has basically let go of that notion. But these people think this is coming. I mean, the amount of dissonance and how they're going to respond to it is sort of terrifying. And it's going to push us to the brink, I think.
Well, I mean, look at the brink we're being pushed to. I mean, this debt ceiling that's, you know, the crisis that looms around that. I mean, who knows what's going to happen? It's, you know, there's a lot of fear-mongering, but this is very real. I mean, I don't think there's an economist on earth or any observer who looks at that and says, you know, that is not a very, very, very dangerous game that is being played around the debt ceiling. And yet, you know, on the right, that's considered, you know, it's not a big deal. Don't worry, we'll be fine. It doesn't matter. Maybe we shouldn't pay those debts. There are a bunch of commies who, you know, have bought America anyway. I mean, there's a lot of very, very strange and frankly, ignorant propaganda.
Well, wait a second. To be fair, Digby, Congressman Ted Yoho, who prior to the 2012 election was a veterinarian specializing in large animals, had this to say. He's from Florida. I think we need to have that moment where we realize we're going broke. And he said, if the debt ceiling isn't, he said, I think personally, speaking of the debt ceiling, it would bring stability to the world markets.
I mean, what do you do with that? I mean, this is one of the things that you just sit there and scratch your head and go, how does one deal with this? I mean, there's no Republican Party discipline, the way that there used to be. I mean, I think that's fairly clear. You know, and I was never sure about that. I mean, you don't know what's really happening behind closed doors in any kind of institution like that. But it's obvious at this point that there really is no, there's no educating Ted Yoho. I mean, he believes what he believes, and he's an idiot. I mean, it's just obvious. And there's a whole bunch of them. And I don't think, you know, there's no Tom DeLay in there with, you know,
right,
with the hidden cameras and the pictures that comes in and says, hey, you know, buddy, Ted, I've got to tell you, you're going to toe the line or these are going to go out. You know, I mean, this is, that kind of thing obviously is no longer in existence in the Republican Party. And I don't know that Tom DeLay did that, but let's just say I suspect he did. So that hammer thing that used to exist, that top-down party discipline is gone. And you have people like this who now are exerting actual political power. And I'm not saying that that's even bad in this sort of abstract democratic sense, because he's got a, you know, Yoho's got a bunch of followers who believe that. So
right,
he's accurately representing their views. And that's really scary. And it gets back to where we are with these people who have been, you know, they've basically been, you know, brainwashed into believing that, and this is through a you know, an absolutely huge web of institutions that have built up ever since the 1970s on the conservative right, that not only, you know, do this for political purposes, they do it for money. I mean, these people are making money,
yes,
doing it. Now, the Kochs are spending money, but, you know, they're making money hand over fist, too. These guys are worth more than $50 billion apiece. And they are, in, you know, they are vastly wealthy. They cannot spend the money. That there's no way they could spend all their money on politics.
Relative to their income, I really think that my lunch today, even in the dollar lunch district of New York City, will be a higher percentage of my assets spent than the $200 million they dropped to fight
exactly.
this.
Exactly.
And exactly.
It's a drop in the bucket. It's you know, it's the change in the couch cushions to them. And yet it's, you know, there's a very good return on their investment on this. I mean, they're not doing it, you know, I think they're true believers. I mean, I think the Koch brothers believe in what they're doing, but it also just, you know, it's not a coincidence that it happens to end up in profits returning to them. Which, you know, that's how guys like them stay rich. But, you know, this is the, you know, that there has been a concerted effort over many, many years to create, and, you know, it's building on something that is, that's always been part of the fabric of American political culture. It's not, they didn't invent it. This, you know, that Hofstadter wrote back in the 50s about, or early 60s, about the paranoid strain in American
right.
life. It's always been there. There's always been this sense, you know, I mean, then you go back and, you know, like lately, I've been writing the, you know, I just post the Lincoln Cooper's Union speech every once in a while, 1859, you know, he's on the brink, that we know what's going to happen, and it's all there. And he saw it as well, this same kind of, you know, the sense that people, that this certain group, and in that case, of course, it was the South, feeling that they are under siege by values that they don't share, and that they are on the brink of losing, and they have to fight to the death, and this sort of grandiose sense of their own power, and that they are, you know, like in the South, they always, you know, they're, one of their soldiers was worth 10 Union soldiers, you know, that kind of thing, is sort of building themselves up in their own minds into being these great patriots and these great, you know, warriors who were going to, you know, prevail once the fight was engaged. That is, you know, that's part of who we are. I mean, that's America, and we're seeing it played out. You know, we've seen it played out in many different ways over the course of our history, and this is kind of the latest version of it. And this time, you know, they're playing with, we're dealing with a world in which America is a superpower with a tremendous amount of responsibility for the world economy, for, you know, I mean, obviously we are pretty much the only great military power. And they're playing with, you know, with fire with this on a level that we haven't seen before. I mean, you know, the level of catastrophe is not just confined to, you know, our little political world. It's actually, you know, this is a global issue. Certainly the debt ceiling thing is. And yet, it, you know, there it is. I mean, it's who we are. People exploit it. They make a lot of money at it.
I want to talk a little bit about this, because that aspect of it, I think, is the one thing that, and, you know, we're on some similar email lists. And, you know, when I look at on the left, the sort of the ballast of the left, at least in terms of politics, as opposed to the right, is sort of the more academic, is more academic. I mean, literally more academic. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that, that is not understood by those on the the academic and those who perceive themselves sort of, you know, that's the world that they think is the most relevant. The part that they don't seem to understand is that you the calculus that people are making never takes into account the fact that this $200 million and the literally probably billion that the Koch brothers have pumped into this machine, this money changes the calculus of literally tens of thousands of people who make this up. I mean, I think like people like you and I are in a sort of a unique position to perceive this because we're in sort of a similar business, but there's just no money there.
Right,
you know what
right.
I mean? Like, you know, so we're not, we may aspire to get the type of money that gets funneled into the red state apparatus or the many, these different groups that crop up and make these ads about these rapey ads or whatever it is. But there's just so much money there that there's no incentive. Even if they don't see the sort of a long-term strategic benefit, there is a benefit, and that is I'm part of this machine and I'm getting paid. And so it's much easier for me to see the strategic benefit because I'm richer because of it. I mean, I think that is
of course
the most underestimated aspect of what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge part of it, and there's more money in it than ever. It's not, you know, there's always been some money in it. I mean, they, you know, these are the people who, you know, originally created direct mail. I mean, they've been doing this stuff for a very long time. But the money has exploded.
Yes.
And, you know, part of that is because the 1%, many of whom are willing to throw vast sums of money because they have it, like we said, it's chump change. This isn't a lot of money to these people. They can support, I mean, talk about job creators. Yeah. I mean, they're creating these jobs, you know, among right-wing professional political propagandists and operatives. These people are there to do this work. That's what they do for a living. And regardless of whether or not it succeeds or whether or not they accomplish whatever the political goal is, they certainly have incentives to do it because it is, you know, it's in their own best interest to do it. And I think what you said is right. I mean, the reason that we know this is because we know by trying to do the things that we do, to get the word out, to just kind of, you know, say something once in a while that might be mildly educational to people who don't read academic tomes or you know, aren't part of the, you know, the circles of the elite on the liberal side, that, you know, how much money it takes to do that
yes.
sort of thing. I mean, to do a radio show or to have a series of radio networks or have a TV show or do those kinds of things, to be able to support that stuff, it is very expensive. I mean, media is not cheap in this country. And basically, you know, how valuable that is, how much it enhances your ability to get your message out. And they're organizing on an actual political level as well. I mean, in that article, the New York Times article, did you read that thing about how Heritage Action has trained 6,000 people? They call them sentinels.
Yes.
They're kind of like Manchurian candidates or something, you know. They send them out on a mission every time they have some sort of operation they need to have go out into town halls and meetings and go to their representatives and basically threaten them, I think. I think that's the idea.
I would like to see an entire piece, frankly, on that. I mean, what are these 6,000 sentinels doing? I mean, the idea that, you know, you could pay and train 6,000 operatives like that, it's stunning. And, you know, in terms of the increase in money, I mean, people have to understand, like, the Koch brothers went from 20 years ago having several hundred million dollars to now having tens of billions of dollars. That's all you need. You don't even need the rest of the 1%. This whole thing
right.
can be financed. You're financing, you know, people have to understand, like, this is the functioning of a major international corporation. That they're financing just to basically put out these messages. And it is, I think it's the most underreported. I mean, we talk about all these numbers, but I don't think people draw a straight line between all the people who are just simply enriching themselves. And, you know, frankly, at the end of the day, you know, we used to think of Republicans as people who just, they're Republican because they don't want to pay taxes. In other words, they want their net dollars at the end of the day to be higher because they don't want to pay taxes. Well, now they're just getting it in terms of all this funding. And so, you know, if we can, we just have the lowest tax rates that we've had in generations, that's good enough for us as long as I'm getting paid to talk about this other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you know, this other stuff, basically, I mean, you know, I hesitate to sound like, you know, sort of predictable here. But the idea that these wealthy people are exploiting and manipulating a bunch of frightened, you know, average white people who have a certain, shall we say, fear of the demographic changes that are happening in the U.S. and various other things. They feel like they're religious people who feel like their values aren't represented, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, you know, these guys have a group of people they can exploit with a lot of demagoguery, and they're doing it. And they're doing it with a vast amount of money that is completely expendable for them. They will never reach a point, honestly, I truly believe this, these people will never reach a point where, you know, they say to themselves, you know what, we really spent too much money, you know, we're going to have to pull back on the political thing because, you know, we've gone through way too much of our money. They just can't. They have so much that it doesn't, they could completely overwhelm the political system if both parties and still have a vast fortune. That's how much money they have. And you know, this is, they will continue to do this because it's actually working for them. I mean, one of the things we haven't discussed is the fact that these sequestration numbers,
yes,
the numbers that basically were the Paul Ryan budget numbers, not they weren't the specifics of the Paul Ryan, you know, how the numbers were dispersed in the budget, but it was the overall numbers. Essentially, the Democrats agreed to that number. Steny Hoyer was on the floor of the House when they were having their big argument over the shutdown, saying, "We took your number. We have your number."
Right.
You know, it's not good enough. So, in that sense, just in the sense of that, the clean CR that the Democrats are asking for is already a gigantic capitulation to an absolutely horrifying reduction in government. It's not enough. They're going to want more, you know.
Indeed. Well, the Republicans have scored the touchdown, and then they said, though, actually we haven't because we just pushed the goalpost another 50 yards.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps happening. So the idea that they're losing or they're going to fundamentally hurt themselves is, to the extent that they are going to injure themselves, and I'm not quite sure that that's the case, they've done so in victory, not in defeat.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it's interesting because there are certain people that kind of give the game away. They can't help it. Grover Norquist, who is an extremely arrogant right-wing operative, very, very in love with the sound of his own voice. The quotes he's given over the past couple of weeks have been very telling. I mean, he's saying, you know, look, we got this one. We did it.
This
we
is
already
gravy,
got, you know.
Right. Anything that happens
just,
next
everything
is gravy.
Else is just, yeah, everything else is just, you know, icing on the cake because we got what we wanted. That he said the only thing we have to do is to protect sequestration. I mean, he is absolutely saying this is it. You know, it's the shrinkage of government. It's the spending cuts that are the key to their long-term success. And he knows that. I mean, obviously, he's now agitating for the, quote, entitlement cuts, which is, you know, the big enchilada. If they can get them, particularly if they can get Democrats to be the ones to, you know, to laud that as a victory of some sort, they will be in, you know, they will have really accomplished a lot. Now, you know, they need to keep the troops fired up, as we've been saying. So they're, you know, it's all, they're dying, they're losing, the other side is overwhelming them, the Democrats are, you know, they're taking over the world, the Muslims, you know, whatever. they're you know, we're killing the greatest generation. I mean, it's all they're going to keep doing that because that's what works. But the fact is that the real operatives, Paul Ryan, Grover Norquist, those people, they get it. They get that in incremental ways, they are winning and against great odds. I mean, it's quite a victory to be able to do that from a majority in one House of Congress. It's, you know, I don't know. Is it unprecedented? Have they ever done that before?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is that now we're hearing the so-called reasonable Republicans saying, hey, maybe we should have that grand bargain after all where we cut Social Security. And you know, you and I have talked about this for literally for years. You have over the years made it very clear, and you have repeatedly pointed out that upon entering office, before even before the inauguration, the Obama administration officials were talking about so-called entitlement reform and a grand bargain and cutting Social Security and cutting Medicare. And, you know, the question I have for you is, what do you think? I mean, how does this, it's impossible to predict, obviously, right now, but I mean, how concerned are you about that? I've seen over the weekend, Dave Weigel was on Up with Steve, and he said it's actually made the grand bargain harder to get to, but I'm not so convinced that we're at that point. Give me your sense.
Well, I don't know. You know, I get what Weigel was saying there, which is, you know, that they've now, because they've gone so far out on a limb on Obamacare, that this is now, you know, it may not be enough. I think what he was saying is that, you know, the right wing isn't going to settle for a grand bargain that's just not, you know, it doesn't give them what they need. But, you know, a lot of people that I've been reading in the press are sort of seeing, you know, you have to look beyond what's happening in the interim. I think that, you know, I believe that the president and the White House and the Democratic leadership understands that they made a big mistake in 2011 by allowing the debt ceiling to be used in any way as leverage, and what they ended up doing. And part of it, you know, you have to be sympathetic to them in some ways. They were facing a re-election. So, you know, taking the debt ceiling to the end with some kind of economic catastrophe on the other end would have spelled doom for their reelection, and God knows what would have we would be looking at President Romney now, or maybe worse, maybe we'd have President Bachman. I mean, who knows?
Right.
But you know, so I have some sympathy for the position they were in 2011. But the result is that the Republicans now see the debt ceiling as a reasonable tool for them to use to get their agenda enacted, and that's a very, very bad and dangerous thing, because in the hands of these crazy people, it's not just something they can say and then everybody will get behind closed doors and agree. These people are taking it all the way out. So I think the White House, I believe them when they say they have to separate the debt ceiling from anything that happens on the budget. They cannot do that. But what that actually means is, it's more of an optic thing than it is reality, in my view, which means that because the Republicans aren't just going to walk away. It's not, you know, this idea, I think, that Democrats are working themselves up into some kind of, you know, delusion that the Republicans are going to come in one day and just go, you know what, you were right, we were wrong, and we're sorry, and here, you know, here's your clean debt.
Here's your world economy. It's fine.
And we're sorry. Here's your world economy. We realize that we went too far, and we feel really bad about it, and we're going to be much better in the future. Please forgive us. I mean, that, I think, is pretty delusional. But they seem to think that they don't have to give anything. Now, I understand that the White House is refusing to give anything on the shutdown and on the debt ceiling overtly, because that,
right,
you know, they have to make this line in the sand, because otherwise every year we'll be doing this. But that doesn't mean a deal isn't going to happen. It has to happen. The Republicans have to get something. They just do. And Ted Cruz kind of indicated yesterday that he thought that they would be willing to settle for some entitlement reform, something on Obamacare, meaning probably the medical device tax, some kind of overall agreement. Now that says grand bargain, right? I mean, And he specifically said that they would not accept any tax increases, which is what the White House has been holding out for. My personal belief is that I think that at this point, the White House may very well say, you know, reversing some of the sequestration cuts in exchange for the chain CPI, that might make sense to them.
What I'm afraid of is a couple of things. One, President Obama has talked about we would be willing to just accept revenue increases through loophole closing, which, of course, is a joke because those loopholes open right back up after the deal is made. But also, I think your point about this being about optics in that the president does not want to have as his legacy the use of the debt ceiling in future generations as a leverage. And so for him, I don't think the concern is that he'll be seen as caving or negotiating if he can get some type of statutory, some type of change in the process that would not allow this to happen again. So in other words...
That's very good. I think I hadn't thought of that. That's an excellent thing. Yeah, that would work. Absolutely.
That's what really scares me. Is because then they could have their win. They could, you know, have leveraged something from the debt ceiling. He's willing to show a cave on that for a little understood, little, you know, whatever, the McConnell provision, the Gephardt provision, whatever it is that makes the debt ceiling not come up again. So his legacy's intact in that regard. And then we also know that I genuinely believe the Obama administration feel, based on the Clinton welfare reform model, that reforming entitlements, i.e. cutting entitlements, is a legacy winner for them.
I believe that, too. I mean, they have, you know, you and I both know that there are many people who want to portray this grand bargain, you know, notion as only a reaction to the terrible Republicans who've been demanding this. That just is not historically accurate. The Obama administration has from the very beginning wanted to tackle these big problems. I think we all know that from the 2008 campaign, he was going to come in, he's going to be the Ronald Reagan of his time, a transformational president, and part of what that was what they termed reform, and it was reform in a number of different areas. First and foremost, health care, check. You know, then there was tax reform, and I don't know if they're going to get that, but there is still time for that. And believe me, that's one that's not going to accrue to the benefit of the good guys either.
Right.
It just won't happen. And then there was this, quote, entitlement reform, some of which has already happened under Obamacare, some of the Medicare reforms that are there, and there's more to be done, which under a grand bargain that has been proposed over the last couple of years, Medicare falls under that, too. There had originally been proposals to raise the age of Medicare. I don't think that will happen, and that's only because Obamacare is not fully implemented, and they can't genuinely say, don't worry, guys, you 66-year-olds, you know, you've got something to fall back on. So they can't do it. But there are other cuts, and that's been part of the grand bargain. There are cuts, hopefully not to benefits, but to providers and what have you.
Yes.
Yeah. And then there's this chain CPI, which, by the way, it has to be noted, and, you know, not that I'm necessarily agitating against this, although I do think it should at least be debated before somebody does it, is a big tax increase. You know, the chain CPI doesn't just affect benefits, which it does. It affects benefits for Social Security recipients and veterans, anybody who's getting any kind of government pensions or any kind of government benefits. Everything is now shifted, and you're going to be getting less than you would have. But you're also going to be paying more in taxes because it changes the tax rates. Now, you know, nobody's made a big deal out of that. Grover Norquist is the only one who ever says anything about it. But and he could pitch a big fit about it, too, if it does come up. But I don't really think – I think the Republicans are okay with that. I think they're okay with that tax increase because it really only it is only relevant to the working and middle class. You know, the rich get hit on a very minimal level by comparison. So I think that is, you know, part of the calculation here of this whole idea of reforming – what was it? How does the president, he phrases it by saying, you know, we need to reform the fundamental structure of how the government spends its money. And that is what he's talking about, is these things where we shift revenue, we shift benefits, we do all this stuff. So in the end, you know, if people look back, I think the idea is 25 years from now, they look back and go, wow, you know, look what they did. And of course, you know, under the circumstances that it was done, oh my God, they were, you know, being attacked from left and right. They called him a Muslim. And he was able to, and the word here is reform. Reform all the government structures. And I honestly think, and I'm not trying to say that he's a bad person for this. I disagree with him. I think he's reforming things in all the wrong ways. But, you know, I do think he genuinely wanted to do this. Yeah. I don't understand why it's so important to say, well, he couldn't help it. I mean, I guess that makes sense to some people that, you know, he's just this completely powerless, impotent, poor guy in the presidency who has no, you know, he just can't do anything. He'd love to do some, you know, much better things for the people, but he can't, so this is the best he can do.
Oh, and I can assure you, I can assure you that every member of this administration who is involved in this, in the event that they actually do that, they will be saying 6 months out of office, we weren't forced for this. Was part of our agenda. I mean, they're going to say this proudly in the same way that we hear over and over again about how great Clinton welfare reform was, as opposed to, hey, it brought us an expansion in food stamps because people couldn't eat because of that when the jobs went away.
Right.
There's no doubt in my mind that they will take full credit for it after the fact. The notion that they've been bullied into it is just simply, I think, a way of getting there. Digby, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us today. We will talk again soon.
Oh, thank you for having me, Sam. Have a great day.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay,
all right,
bye-bye.
Folks. We are going to we ran a little late with Digby, but how could you not? We're going to head into the better half of the program. Folks, check out majority.fm. We've got our sponsor this month is Credo Mobile. When you get a Credo phone and Credo phone service, you're supporting Credo Action. I think they're involved in this Keystone protest in Boston. This week, I think we're going to have Becky Bond on from Credo Action to talk about what Credo's been up to, particularly in the context of this this government shutdown and maybe the debt ceiling fight. When we go into the better half, we're going to talk more about the government shutdown. About 400,000 workers are off furlough. There's civilian, about 350, I think it is, civilian military workers. And all furloughed workers have been promised pay, back pay, for jobs that they haven't been doing because, of course, that makes fiscal sense, I guess. We will talk more about that in the better half. You can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm or going to majority.fm, clicking on that Credo deal. You get up to $350 credit to pay off any switching fees that you might have if you get out of contract in your current phone service, and you get 25% off your data use for the next 2 years with that Credo. Check it out. There's a coupon code on the top of the page that you'll land at. Also, if you buy junk from Amazon, buy it through our link at majority.fm. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. See you in the better half. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM or via the app. Also, podcastawards.com. Nominate us, if you haven't already, for Best News and Political Show and People's Choice. Voting will start, I think, in a couple of weeks. We'll let you know when. All right, see you in the better half.